It's generally accepted that Afrikaans is a language that morphed and was adapted from its root, Dutch, heavily influenced by the tongues, the languages of slaves and migrants and indentured laborers here to the Cape. Koi words, they also pepper what's considered the world's youngest and newest language. But there's also been the history along the way of the politicization of Afrikaans, the development of a political ideology of apartheid through Afrikaans. What few out of Cape Town know is the largely untold story of CAPS and its role in the evolution of Afrikaans. Afrikaans is my moedertaal. It's my mother language. And I'm very proud of it. English is my first language. I'm also very proud and happy that I speak English. But the way I think, communicate, how I relate to the people around me, from where I come from, is probably in CAPS. And historically speaking, you know, we could also be argued that CAPS preceded the form of Afrikaans that we now come to officially accept now as standardized Afrikaans because of its influence of slaves and workers during the past. So it was very, very interesting that I saw that moves are being made to not necessarily formalize, but to at least document, record CAPS as a method to give it power and also to give it legitimacy amongst the people that it speaks. Joining me now is Quentin Williams. He's a professor of social linguistics, linguistic anthropology, popular culture, and multilingualism at the University of the Western Cape. Quentin, thanks so much for coming here onto the Morning Review. How are you doing?
I'm good, Lester. Happy to be here with you. I'm smiling from ear to ear.
Yeah, that's great. Look, when we talk about dialects, we talk about vernacular. What's the difference between a dialect and slang from a social linguistic point of view? What is then the difference between a dialect and slang?
Yes, so a dialect is spoken by a community, and it usually shares formal or features of other dialects of one particular language. And social linguists have documented the spread of dialects across geographical regions. And usually we call those social linguists dialectologists. And so they look at a particular map, geographical map, and they try to understand the spread of particular forms, small forms of sounds and words that are of a particular language that spreads around a a geographical region. In the case of, for example, South Africa, we have many dialects that is spread across South Africa, many dialects of English, for example, dialects that have historically been racialized, for example, Cape Colored English, or Cape Flats English, or Black South African English, you know. So that gives if we focus on dialects of English, it gives us a very important picture of the spread and the uptake of that particular dialect. A slang or a vernacular is not as, let's say, prestigious as a dialect, because it is usually is used with lower functions, usually amongst speakers in an informal way, or in the case of slaves at the Cape who worked in the kitchen, they spoke a particular vernacular or compass a variety of speech.
When we talk about the formalization of a language or a dialect, look, it's been done before already through already published literary works. I'm thinking of the writing of Adam Small, Peter Snyder, Ikus Ook Important. I'm talking about the Trantrau brothers, who have already in serious literary circles, in mainstream Afrikaans newspapers, have already written and expressed express their thoughts and ideas through the language of CAPS already.
Yes, exactly. But you see, this when we talk in layman terms about formalization, in very technical, specific terms, we linguists and social linguists refer to as standardization. Now, the problem for CAPS is that for a very long time, the writers that you've mentioned have written and are writing in the language on text. So they are providing documents that we can trace how to write in specific ways in CAPS. Standardization, however, is the more important step to empowering a particular language like CAPS. So in other words, as a community informed by the specialists, the social linguists, we will select, for example, a particular variety or dialect of CAPS, and then we will then codify that variety in terms of unifying the grammar. We all agree that we will write this particular way. Because, you know, the problem with CAPS is Nathan Trontrell writes one way, Andre writes one way, Adam Small and others also write a different way. So which way is the correct way? But we are not having that conversation yet. So that's another step, codification. Part of codification is the step that we are at the moment taking. That is developing a dictionary where we map out not only the history of particular words, where they come from, how they are, how they sound, how they can be phonetically described, but also the many ways certain words are used and written down. And then the last step would be to elaborate it in schools, in the economy, in political life, in our religion, because, you know, we have pastors who preach in CAPS, but most of them are in outside.
Intense.
You know, an intenter. Those ones who preach inside, they tend to follow a more formal standard variety. But that's what we mean by elaboration. Once we reach that stage, we are empowered.
Let me just go to a quick call. Bruce is in observatories, is very keen to start talking about dialects. And good morning, right. Bruce. How are you doing?
Good morning, sir. Yeah, I'm very interested in your discussion this morning, and I'm digressing a little, but I've done a bit of studying of dialects, particularly in Scotland. I mean, I've been in Cape Town for many, many years, but it always interested me why the people from Glasgow, where I come from, talk with a different dialect to those in Edinburgh, and also talk in a different dialect to those between Cape Town and Musenburg in Scotland, that same distance. They actually speak with a different dialect. I went into this quite a bit, and the reason in Scotland or in Britain, UK, why that happened was because many, many years ago when people lived in communities, and I was from Glasgow and I went to Edinburgh, right? The people from Edinburgh would all immediately know that I wasn't from Edinburgh. And it was all to do with protecting your community. So if I went in there as not a spy, but I went in there to do something naughty in Edinburgh, the people from Edinburgh could immediately pick up, wait a minute, you're not from Edinburgh. And I find it very interesting. And in Scotland, it's amazing how little distance. I mean, from here, from Observatory to Constantia or Plumstead, they actually talk with a different, slightly different dialect. It's quite amazing.
Bruce Inobs, thanks so much. Look, my Afrikaans hier in die Kaap, Quentin, is very different towards my wife's Noord-Kaapse Afrikaans.
Right, yeah. So think about it this way. If one community is divided by a mountain from another community, but your forebearers spoke one language, but then one of the forebearers decided to leave to the other side of the mountain. The generation that he or she births evidentially will speak a different variety the vowel system or the consonant system at a very fine, specific linguistic level might change because of the isolation of that particular community. And one example, is in Papua New Guinea, all these isolated islands, where, for example, on one island, the community speaks Tok Pisin, but with trade and globalization from other islands, technology, another variety came into the community, and the newer generation of speakers then chose that variety because that gave them upward mobility and it empowered them economically. So I don't know much about Scotland, but I know a little bit of history of English and the invasion of, like, you know, the Vikings and so forth. I know, of course, Latin, and English is, of course, is made up of a confluence of dialects as a result of invasions and mobility. We need to remember that language is not outside ourselves. It is ourselves. And our mobility impacts on the transformation as well as the uptake of particular ways of speaking. Those are the factors that we need to take into consideration.
So you're planning and you're trying to formalize the development of a trilingual CAPS dictionary. Why trilingual?
Yes. The idea there is that if we discussed that if we focused only on CAPS, then we would cater only for the CAPS speakers. But we asked ourselves, would that then limit the understanding of South Africans of CAPS speakers? Because essentially, CAPS speakers want to move away from the stereotype that they speak against the language. You know, that they are associated with so many negative stereotypes. And so in order for other speakers who speak English and Afrikaans to minimize intercultural, cross-cultural miscommunication, or in this case, intercultural miscommunication, other speakers need to understand how a word like aware or a word like honesty can be translated into Standard Afrikaans and what that means in Standard Afrikaans, but then at the same time, what it means in English. So that's what our dictionary will attempt to do, to provide that particular information. And in a way, if we do that, it legitimizes CAPS speakers as a deeply rich a language. And that's I want to add this point that CAPS speakers, they are seen as not speaking a language because they are often thought of as speakers of a variety of Afrikaans or speak a dialect of Afrikaans. If we are to empower CAPS speakers, we need to insist that they speak a language because a basic definition of language is the use of a system of signs. That signs can be verbal or nonverbal, used by a community of speakers. And I think that definition applies to speakers of CAPS.
But that's why I started the conversation. When is a word slang, and when is a word a dialect? When I talk about word, what examples can I use? If I use the word, for example, geteig, in what would be used in a CAPS context, geteig would mean speak, talk.
Yeah.
But in another context, I'm giving evidence.
Exactly.
So when does a slang word just simply become a dialect?
Or enters into a dialect of a speaker. I mean, geteig, and that's a very good word, and we need to understand its etymology. But maybe a better word is the word aware. And this is a word that was initially used as a verb in Old Javanese. Now, we know for certain that before the Dutch came, there were ships coming, bringing slaves from the Dutch colony Batavia, known as Java, which is close to Indonesia. And some of those slaves were, you know, Abram from Batavia, Anna de Koning. Those are the names of the slaves who we know who came. Now, the word aware comes from where in Old Javanese, and it was transformed by the slave speakers of Kaap, what Kaap's Holland. Mm. That's the first sort of the understanding of what we know as the oldest label of Kaap's, mm. Kaap's Holland. So the speakers of Kaap's Holland transformed where, that means to give or just give from Old Javanese, mm. to a greeting word, aware, and it is still used today, this word aware, mm. in Indonesia. An example I can give you is when a speaker says, Jana awe diwut marang Petrus, it means John gave money to Peter. Mm. So that important transformation of aware, mm. Aware in Old Javanese to aware as a greeting word is extremely important, and how it entered from the mouth of slaves into the mouth of speakers who became highly racialized. Mm. Now, in the old colonial time of South Africa, we also know that this word was taken up by the Khoi and Sun speakers, also as a greeting word. But it was also influenced very likely by Arabic-speaking Muslims or Malay at the Cape in the use of the word awefe, that is meaning to give you good health. Yeah. So all of those transformations in the meaning of the word and how it was taken up by speakers who were slaves first, who were thought to speak the vernacular, not worthy of speaking a pure form of Afrikaans, mm. not worthy of being included in the standardization of Afrikaans. All of those transformations have brought us up to this point where mm. we need to ask the kind of questions that, okay, what is the true step we take to now finally empower these speakers, you know?
Quentin, people asking for examples of Kaap's words. You're the social linguistics professor. I'll leave you to answer that. But first, welcome back. We go back now to Professor Quentin Williams, of Professor of Linguistics at UWC. So people are asking, what are some of the examples, Quentin, of yeah. Kaap's words?
Yeah, here's the thing about what's so unique about Kaap speakers is that we tend to and have over generations manipulated the lexical phonological character or the word sound system of the way we speak. Like, so when you, for example, describe or see somebody that is wearing a Christmas jersey with unkempt hair in July, you won't say as a Kaap speaker that what that person is wearing is looks underster, because it looks underster. Mm. But we add a particular or lay it with meaning. But what's interesting about that particular word is because it is the way that it is manipulated phonologically from the standard word. Unders mm. or underster, and that I think is what we often don't pay attention to in the creation of new Kaap's word, and I think that is in extremely important. But you know, we love, I think Kaap speakers are very creative with greetings. Like we would say ahoy instead of hi. Mm. That's just how we have culturally taken up a particular word. But that's a particular word that is probably not historically unique to Kaap speakers, because Rastafarians use it when they say Ahoy Ja Rastafari. But it's a word that can be traced far back to the Nordic Vikings, which is quite interesting. You would ask yourself, like, okay, why the Nordic Vikings? Well, we don't have to go far back to the Treaty of Tordesillas. And in 1494, when the Portuguese and Spanish decided to carve up the world, mm. you go left, we go right. But we know that the word ahoy comes from hoy, from seafaring mm. language. when you know when you see a one boat coming far away,
and ahoy,
you say ahoy, you know, oh. You there, you know, or ships ahoy. But you know, this is the thing. When you pick up the phone, and you either say away ahoy, but then that's interesting because Alexander Graham Bell first suggested that when you pick up the phone, you say ahoy instead of hi. But it didn't sort of quite work out, and so we switched to hi or hello.
Hello.
Yes.
So who's been brought on to formalize and create this dictionary, and how do you prevent a situation where there is where this is kept under a key, where there is gatekeeping, and I also would want to see a situation where we have a Académie Française who dictates what is French or not. If you really want to peeve off a French person or someone who sees themselves as speaking purely strict French, you say le weekend, and they will absolutely they'll throw a baguette at you. But how do you then prevent that gatekeeping that says only this is the real definition or the real version of this particular word or this particular dialect?
Yes, this is the problem that colonial linguists and missionary linguists left us with, that in the past they created word lists, and I know there are many word lists on the web sites or on the internet about carbs, words with meanings. Those are not dictionaries. Mm-hmm. And the colonial linguists and missionary linguists, they made word lists and also messed up many of the grammars of you know, speakers and communities in other countries, and they've created, in part, and of course, apartheid exacerbated this, the inequalities that we are currently dealing with. What this dictionary is a descriptive dictionary. So in other words, it will not prescribe how you should, or which words you should use, or how you should spell, but rather describe the many ways that you can write particular words. Like, for example, the word aware can be spelled with an H at the end or without. Depending on in which region of the country you come from.
I'm an advocate. I'm a strong advocate that away is spelt A-W-E-H.
Yes.
That's a hill I will die on.
Yeah, so yes, of course. And to you as well. And I hope that you have a bulletproof vest before you die on that hill. But it's important to know that, you know, we are not at the stage of standardization or talk about standardization. If the community wants to standardize carbs, it is our duty as linguists to then develop out of this descriptive dictionary a prescriptive dictionary that tells us how exactly to spell this particular word, because we want to develop the literacy skills of academic literacy skills and basic communication skills of our children who speak carbs.
What is one of my favorite things about Cape Town, Quinton, and when I used to live in Woodstock, and I would often walk down to Salt River Circle, and we go to the stores on Main Road, and I would often pass a group of children coming from school who were clearly the children of African migrants to Cape Town. And they would sound, how they would sound would be like they were children from Cape Town. And there's often this conversation about appropriation. I see nothing wrong with whether you're a black person, a colored person, a white person, a migrant, someone who's moved even here quite recently from Europe or any other part of the country, of the world, to start using words like aware, usit, mebru.
Right.
Because what I've experienced in other parts of the world, and particularly in a city like New Orleans, in terms of that Creole, Cajun, French, Spanish, African patois that gets created, I think that is very important, not to create an homogenous culture, but a culture that we share and a language that we share. And carbs could very much and very well be that.
Yeah, the current research from the department that I am in the linguistics department at UWC and other departments as well, do show that migrants take up carbs because it is in your environment. This is your environment is not impoverished of carbs. It is part of it. And so the uptake by Congolese migrants, for example, to use carbs, they use carbs or they take up carbs so that they can communicate with their peers at school. Mm. They understand that in the use of carbs outside the classroom will benefit them to form part of a particular identity group. Mm. And I think the stakes is always low when we are in language context situations where we learn particular words and meanings of words, or phrases like, you know, bek for koop, you know, which is a very unique sort of a phrase to carb speakers. Mm. Where the stakes are high is when those are in power want to impose particular forms of language. When they say, oh, you don't speak correct carbs or correct Afrikaans, or you don't speak pure Afrikaans or Saver Afrikaans. Mm. There is no such thing as Saver Afrikaans. It's a racist label created by the apartheid government. And it was sustained by apartheid linguistics research. We need to really move away from that particular theories and thinking so that we can better understand how CARB speakers in contact with migrant speakers really enrich our multilingual South Africa. That's the only way that we will transform ourselves for the better and our in the future.
Professor Quentin Williams, linguistics professor at the University of Western Cape. Fascinating conversation. Hope you do well with developing this dictionary. I hope it benefits all of us who call this particular city home. Thank you so much for joining us.